Coming up on Star Stuff.
Scientists say they're closing in on the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle. The last total lunar eclipse till 2014 puts on a spectacular display. And more evidence of liquid water on the surface of ancient Mars. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Scientists say they've found strong signs for the Higgs boson, that elementary subatomic particle believed to have played a key role in the Standard Model of Particle Physics. The boson's thought to generate something called a Higgs field, which gives mass and energy to all the other particles of matter. And it's this property which has led to it being nicknamed the God particle. It was first theorized back in 1964 by British physicist Professor Peter Higgs. He proposed the existence of the particle as the missing link in a grand theory of matter and energy. The search for the Higgs has led to the construction of the world's biggest particle accelerator, the LHC, or Large Hadron Collider, a 27-kilometre-long circular underground tunnel below the Franco-Swiss border at CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research near Geneva. Physicists from both the ATLAS and CMS detectors at CERN say their separate experiments have independently found strong signs leading them to believe they're closing in on the Higgs. But they were quick to warn that their results have not yet reached the level of certainty that would let them claim a discovery. Discovery of the Higgs would fill the last remaining hole in the Standard Model. However, that doesn't mean that it must exist, and there are heaps of physicists out there, including Stephen Hawking, who don't really believe it does exist. And that's where the $10 billion Large Hadron Collider comes in. It's been smashing subatomic particles together at close to 99.9% light speed, in the process recreating the sorts of pressures and temperatures that existed in the moments after the Big Bang of creation 13.7 billion years ago. It's these sort of conditions which should allow particles such as the Higgs boson to be found and studied. While the boson's discovery would cement current knowledge about particles such as electrons and photons, proof that it does not exist would undermine foundations of accepted theories concerning the makeup of the universe. Put simply, it would require new physics. The Higgs boson particle itself is theorized to be very short-lived, so that it could only be detected from particles that it decays into, and that's what the search has been doing. In the course of millions of collisions, scientists have been hunting for a significant excess of a particular combination of decay particles. And although they're now converging on a particular profile for the Higgs, they'll still need at least another year's worth of collisions in order to rule out a statistical fluke. But CERN's director Rolf Hoyer says that means the researchers are getting closer.
The Large Hadron Collider has worked extremely well and has given the experiments a lot of statistics which allows them now to close the window for the allowed mass range of this Standard Model Higgs boson. That's number one. Now number two is that within this still allowed mass region, there are some intriguing fluctuations.
Professor Geoffrey Taylor is a physicist with the University of Melbourne and is part of the ATLAS detector team.
We know that something's missing. The Standard Model is based on a beautiful mathematical symmetry, and that mathematical symmetry would lead to the conclusion that all of the fundamental particles of matter, like the electron and the quarks, would all have a zero mass, which we know is not true. So somehow the beautiful symmetry has a slight breaking to it, the beauty spot on the perfect face. If the Higgs boson is not there, we know we have to find another ingredient to account for some of the missing ingredients of the Standard Model. So if it's not the Higgs boson, then it's something new, and that could be even more exciting. If with the extra data we eliminate the Higgs boson, then we have to find something else. For example, it could mean extra dimensions of space, which would be another frontier that would be of incredible importance. So whatever happens, we know we have to discover something in the next year or so.
Planet Earth's been treated to its last lunar eclipse until 2014, and Australia was one of the best places on the planet to view the cosmic spectacular. A lunar eclipse occurs when the Earth moves between the Sun and the Moon and its shadow falls on the lunar surface. When the moon's totally eclipsed, it glows eerily orange, red, or even a dark reddish brown. That reddish colour is caused by sunlight being refracted through the Earth's atmosphere. The main culprit's an effect called Rayleigh scattering, the same thing which on Earth makes sunsets look orange or red and the broad daylight sky blue. Dust and other particulate matter suspended in the atmosphere also plays a small part. Although the moon's completely inside the Earth's shadow during a total lunar eclipse, it's still dimly lit by sunlight that skims around the edge of the Earth and is refracted into the Earth's shadow by the atmosphere. To someone standing on the surface of the moon looking up towards the Earth, the sun would be completely covered by the dark disk of the Earth. And that disk would be ringed all round by a thin, brilliant band of reddish-orange light, bright enough to dimly illuminate the lunar landscape. Unlike an eclipse of the sun, a lunar eclipse is visible to everyone on the entire moon-facing side of the world at once. The last lunar eclipse was great for those people viewing it from places like Australia and the Western Pacific. In the United States and Canada, however, moon set and sun rise shortened the show the further east you went. People on the Western Plains also had the horizon of the Rockies to deal with, and those on the Atlantic coast missed out completely. For Europe and Africa, the eclipsed moon was there, but it was much lower in the sky and far to the east during or just after twilight. Now, there will be another lunar eclipse on June the 4th next year, but that'll only be a partial eclipse. The next total lunar eclipse doesn't happen until the night of April the 14th and 15th, 2014. Scientists studying the interior of huge stars known as red giants have discovered that they rotate faster on the inside. Using astroseismology, Professor Tim Bedding from the University of Sydney, together with fellow researchers, found the cores of red giants rotate at least 10 times faster than their surfaces. The findings, reported in the journal Nature, will help scientists better understand stellar evolution, and it provides a new insight into the ultimate fate of our own sun in 5 billion years' time. When a star exhausts its supply of hydrogen fuel from the core, the central region contracts and the outer envelope expands and cools, giving rise to the red giant phase. To conserve the angular momentum of these stars, the core needs to rotate faster than the surface, but up until now, there's only been indirect evidence for this. The new work provides actual observational evidence by using rotational frequency splitting of recently detected mixed modes of oscillation in red giants. Bedding and colleagues used data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope to analyze pressure waves inside the stars, which appear as rhythmic variations on the stellar surface. But the effect of rotation on the frequencies of the waves is so small, it took researchers nearly 2 years of almost continuous data gathering from Kepler to make their discovery. Red giants were once stars like our sun, but as they age, their outer layers expand to more than 5 times their original size, in the process cooling down significantly, making them glow red. But deep inside, the opposite's actually happening. The core of a red giant becomes extremely hot and extremely dense. The physics involved is similar to that of an ice skater performing pirouettes. Ice skaters will spin faster if their arms are pulled tightly towards their bodies. And that's exactly what the fast-spinning contracted core of red giants do. NASA's Kepler Space Telescope is searching for Earth-like planets orbiting nearby stars. But it's also proving to be a useful tool for understanding processes within stars. That's because Kepler is able to detect very small variations in a star's brightness of only a few parts per million. Because of this unique feature, its measurements are ideally suited for detecting the tiny brightness fluctuations of stars. And this has allowed scientists to undertake astroseismology, which works in a similar way to geologists using seismic waves from earthquakes to better understand the Earth's interior. Scientists have found the fastest rotating massive star ever recorded. The star spinning around its axis at some 600 kilometers per second at the equator. That's a rotational velocity so high that the star is nearly tearing itself apart through centrifugal force. The observations were made using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, or VLT, in Chile. It's part of a survey of the heaviest and brightest stars in the Tarantula Nebula. A star-forming region in the Large Magellanic Cloud, a satellite galaxy to our own Milky Way galaxy, located about 160,000 light-years away. The reported star VFTS-102 is extremely hot and luminous, shining about 100,000 times more brightly than the Sun. This star has a violent past, having been ejected out of a binary system by its exploding companion. Scientists say stars can achieve such rapid rotation through a gravitational interaction with another star, which has stripped gas from its surface. This gas falls onto the other star, increasing the mass and spinning it up. A report in Astronomy and Astrophysics Letters suggests the star is unusual not just because it's rotating so quickly, but also because it's moving away from its neighbouring stars at some 30 kilometres per second. Having been part of a binary system neatly explains the space oddity. Astronomers have long known that a star in a massive binary system can be shot away from its surroundings when the companion ends its life in a spectacular explosion called a supernovae. And in this case, the star is located close to a pulsar and a supernova remnant, which may well be all that's left of its binary companion. The European Space Agency has again tried to re-establish communications with the failed Russian Mars probe, Phobos Grunt. However, experts say the condition of the 14-ton spacecraft, which has been in extremely low Earth orbit since its launch back on November the 8th, is continuing to worsen. Now, there are reports that sections of the crippled spacecraft have been seen falling off. Now, these could be solar arrays that are being torn off as the probe's decaying orbit brings it lower in altitude and into contact with the tenuous upper atmosphere of the Earth. As atmospheric drag increases, the spacecraft will slow down even more, causing more orbital decay, slowing its speed even further, and bringing it into even thicker atmosphere, until eventually it'll fall from the sky completely and come crashing back down to the surface. The mission's launch aboard a Zenit rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan went smoothly. Phobos Grunt being placed in its temporary transfer orbit right on schedule 8 minutes after launch. However, once in orbit, Phobos Grunt suddenly went silent, and repeated attempts by the Russian space agency Roscosmos to re-establish communications failed. Mission controllers were able to confirm both engine burns failed to take place, leaving Phobos Grunt trapped in its low Earth orbit. After 2 weeks of unsuccessful attempts to contact the spacecraft, Russian mission controllers were told that a satellite tracking station in the Western Australian capital city of Perth was able to make contact with the probe. The ESA-operated facility was given codes to upload instructions to the spacecraft, ordering it to turn on its transmitters and download telemetry. However, the communications window was only open for a few minutes during each orbit, while the ground station was in direct line of sight of the spacecraft. And after a few days, communications with Perth was lost as the orbit migrated. Roscosmos then asked ESA to try to re-establish communications through its Maspalmas tracking station in Spain. However, those attempts have proven to be unsuccessful. Unless control of the crippled spacecraft can be re-established in the next week or so, Phobos Grunt will crash and burn, sometime in January. Bit of good Martian news now, and NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Opportunity has found bright veins of a mineral, apparently gypsum, deposited by water near the rim of Endeavour Crater. Principal investigator for the Opportunity rover, Steve Squires from Cornell University, says the discovery's a slam dunk, showing that water once flowed through underground fractures in the rock. Squires says the veins represent a pure chemical deposit of gypsum that formed in situ right where Opportunity detected it. The vein examined most closely by Opportunity is about 2 centimetres wide and between 40 and 50 centimetres long. And it wasn't alone. It was one of many identical deposits found around the rim of the Endeavour crater. Nothing like this has ever been seen before in the 33 kilometres of crater-pocked plains that Opportunity's explored for the past 90 months before it reached Endeavour, nor in the higher ground around the crater's rim. Last month, researchers used the microscopic imager, an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer aboard the robot's arm, and multiple filters in the panoramic camera on the rover's mast to examine the vein, which has been informally named Homestake. The spectrometer identified lots of calcium and sulfur in a ratio pointing to a relatively pure form of calcium sulfate. Calcium sulfate can exist in many forms, varying only by how much water is bound into the mineral's crystalline structure. And the multi-filtered data from the camera suggests gypsum, a hydrated calcium sulfate. On Earth, gypsum's used for making drywall and plaster of Paris. Observations from orbit had detected gypsum on Mars previously. A dune field of wind-blown gypsum in far northern Mars resembles the glistening gypsum dunes of White Sands National Monument in New Mexico. The origin of that wind-blown gypsum sand is, however, uncertain, while at Homestake, the mineral is right there where it formed. The Homestake deposit, whether gypsum or another form of calcium sulfate, is likely formed from water dissolving calcium out of volcanic rocks. The calcium is combined with sulfur that was either leached from the rocks or introduced as volcanic gas. It was then deposited as calcium sulfate into an underground fracture that later became exposed at the surface. The discovery of gypsum fits the emerging picture of Mars as an ancient wet environment. Throughout Opportunity's long traverse across Mars's Meridiani Planum, the rover's been driving over bedrock composed of magnesium, iron, and calcium sulfate minerals that also indicate the presence of water billions of years ago. The highly concentrated calcium sulfate at Homestake, however, could have been produced in conditions far more neutral than the harshly acidic conditions indicated by the other sulfate deposits observed by Opportunity. In other words, it could have been formed in a different type of water environment, one more hospitable for a larger variety of living organisms. Opportunity's been exploring Mars for nearly 8 years now, far exceeding the rover's original 3-month mission plan, which began back in 2004. Gypsum veins are just the latest example of an important discovery about wet environments on ancient Mars that may have been favourable for supporting microbial life. And until recently, Opportunity wasn't alone. Its equally productive twin rover Spirit has also delivered a bag full of new discoveries and only stopped communicating in 2010. Opportunity, however, is continuing its exploration, currently heading to a sun-facing slope on the northern end of the Endeavour Rim fragment called Cape York. There it will park itself in such a manner to keep its solar panels at a favourable angle during what will be the mission's fifth Martian winter. Well, speaking of Mars, imagine living and working on a spacecraft for more than 500 days. That's the amount of time it would take to send a human crew to Mars and get them back again. Well, 6 crew members in Russia have done just that. They've spent nearly a year and a half in total isolation inside a replica space module designed to simulate a mission to Mars. And they did it all without leaving a building in Moscow. Now their mission's over, they face readjusting to everyday life. More from the ABC's Norman Hermant.
Inside a research institute in a Moscow suburb, a door that hasn't budged in 520 days swings open, and 6 crew members emerge, home as it were, after a simulated journey to Mars and back. For nearly a year and a half, they have worked, eaten, and slept within meters of each other, in the small replica dimensions of a future Mars spacecraft. Romain Shaw is a crew member with the European Space Agency.
After 520 days of a motionless trip, we are proud to prove that human can go to Mars.
The crew came from Russia, Europe, and China. They lived as they would on a flight to Mars. Communications to mission control were delayed to simulate the distance from Earth. There was even a mock exploration of the Martian surface, all to better study how humans will cope with the isolation required to someday travel to other planets. Igor Ushakov is the director of the Institute of Medical and Biological Problems, which hosted the experiment. Such a long-term experiment was conducted for the first time, he says. It will undoubtedly become a part of the history of experimental work and space exploration. Simulations like this, involving long periods of isolation, have gone wrong in the past. But in an interview just hours before the experiment ended, Romain Charles said this time there were no problems.
Did you expect there to be more problems, or were you pleasantly surprised that everyone got along during this 520 days?
Yeah, I must say I was pleasantly surprised. I knew that a lot could happen in such a small crew for such a long duration isolation. So it was a very nice surprise to get along together so well for such a long time.
Cosmonaut Sergei Ryzhansky was part of a Mars flight simulation about one-fifth as long as this one. He's convinced they are invaluable, despite the fact that the harsh external conditions of space can't be replicated.
Definitely, this is really, really useful experiments. We're testing and developing new methods, new equipment, new strategy, how to train to live in such a condition.
Those behind this simulated journey hope it answers one question about a future Mars mission. If engineers can build the right spacecraft, humans are more than capable of making the trip.
The ABC's Norman Hermant there. A new NASA survey has found that over 1,000 asteroids big enough to cause catastrophic damage on Earth are orbiting relatively close by. Known as SpaceGuard, the project used NASA's Wide-Field Infrared Survey Explorer spacecraft, better known as WISE, to identify an estimated 93% of all near-Earth asteroids a kilometre in diameter or larger. It also found some 20,500 smaller near-Earth asteroids. Previous studies estimated there were between 36,000 to 100,000 of these objects, with diameters of 100 metres or more, diameters large enough to cause devastating impact were one to hit the Earth. An asteroid or comet between 5 and 10 kilometres wide is thought responsible for the Chicxulub crater impact event 65 million years ago. That's the one which triggered the planet's last great mass extinction event, a catastrophe which killed 75% of all life on Earth, including all the dinosaurs other than birds. Scientists are now using archived WISE observations to home in on potentially hazardous objects whose orbits come within 7.4 million kilometres of the Earth. Knowing where these objects are is important. However, so far, there's still no firm plan on exactly what to do when the next big Earth-impacting asteroid is identified. All we know for sure is that they've hit the Earth before and they will again. The European Space Agency and Ariane Space have confirmed Europe's newest rocket, the Vega, will undertake its maiden flight early in the new year. Vega is a new small-capacity launch vehicle designed to take 1.5-ton payloads into low Earth orbit. The Italian-built launch vehicle will carry a scientific satellite named Ares on its first mission, most likely in January or February. Vega is using the old Ariane 1 launch facility at the Kourou Space Center in French Guiana. The Ariane 5 remains Europe's heavy-lift launch vehicle, capable of carrying up to 12 tons into space. The Russian Soyuz provides its medium-lift launch capacity, capable of carrying 7 tons and replacing the old Ariane 4. And the new Vega will provide Ariane Space and the European Space Agency with a new small-lift capacity. The Russian Proton M rocket has successfully launched a new Chinese telecommunications satellite. The Russian space agency Roscosmos says the AsiaSat 7 was flown from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. The satellite was built by Space Systems Lorel for a Hong Kong-based television company called Asia Satellite Communications. It'll provide TV coverage over most of Southeast Asia. And finally this week, there have been celebrations in the sleepy rural central western town of Parkes. The star of the show has been the CSIRO's 64-metre Parkes radio telescope, which has been celebrating its 50th birthday. In its 50 years of service, the dish has become one of the most successful scientific instruments in the country. Its first triumph was the discovery of quasars, and on several occasions, it's held the record for the most distant objects known in the universe. The telescope also discovered the interstellar magnetic fields, which marshal millions of stars into the long spiral arms that form the Milky Way galaxy. At one stage, Parkes laid credit to the discovery of over half of the total number of known pulsars. And it's also been a major player in SETI's search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's even starred in its own movie called The Dish, which told the story of Parkes' involvement in bringing the world those historic first pictures of the Apollo 11 manned moon mission. More from the ABC's Bronwyn Herbert.
Set among paddocks of yellow canola, golden wheat and sheep, the Parkes telescope is known for its role in helping broadcast one of modern history's biggest events, images of the first man landing on the moon, which were made famous in the movie The Dish.
We just got word from Houston. Let's go for launch.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
Astronaut Neil Armstrong lands on the moon. People all over the world will be watching television pictures provided by the receiving dish in the town of Parkes.
So what's this all about?
We've got the moonwalk.
Hey?
The moonwalk?
But as CSIRO's chief astronomer, Professor Phil Diamond, explains, the telescope's role goes far beyond NASA moon missions.
Making the first map of the magnetic field in our own galaxy, discovering... more pulsars, these are the rotating remnants of supernova exploding stars, discovering more, in fact, twice as many as any other all the other telescopes in the world combined. Huge range of science, and it's still doing world-class science today.
At the age of 50, is it relatively old for a telescope? And if so, is it quickly superseded by new technology?
I would say... like many of us, in fact, I'm slightly older than the telescope. It's in its middle age. The concrete and the metal are more or less the same as when it was built 50 years ago. But all of the electronics, the receiver systems, and all of the electronics behind that system leading into the modern computers, it's the equipment that we put on it that makes it state of the art. And it has a very strong future because it is still the largest radio astronomy telescope in the Southern Hemisphere.
Marcus Price is an emeritus professor at the University of New Mexico.
I sometimes say immodestly that I think I know more about the telescope than anybody else alive, partly because I was here as they were finishing the building of it and doing all the checkout on the control system, the servo system, the drive system, and the antennas and the receivers. Plus the fact then that when I became officer in charge, I, of course, went back and studied all the mechanical aspects of the telescope because it's, you know, our most important product is to keep the telescope 100% reliable so it was available for observers when they needed it.
He says he has many special memories from Parkes.
The first memorable moment, I suppose, was when they were doing testing on it initially, and this involved doing the vibrational testing of the telescope to determine what its primary modes of vibration were. And they would do this by running it up to full speed and then slamming on the brakes. And it would make this rather noisy stop and rattle around a bit. And I found that rather disconcerting.
Well, did you think you were going to be thrown about?
Or? Well, no, I really thought the whole thing might just come down after one of these hundreds of tests like that that did. Of course, after a while, I learned that indeed, it was quite substantial and nothing was going to happen. But the first couple of times that happened, I really looked over my shoulder a bit, making sure I knew where the door was.
Now tell me, Professor Price, did they ever play cricket on the dish?
I don't recall cricket ever being played on the dish, although I have heard a rumor that one of the early graduate students and one of his colleagues did play a little baseball up there once. I mean, you don't lose the ball when you miss it. When it goes over your head, it just rolls back down to you.
Astronomers say the Parkes telescope keeps Australia at the forefront of radio astronomy and is capable of serving science for many decades to come.
The ABC's Bronwyn Herbert reporting. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.